remains stationary. What we need to do is to find this quiet center within us and retreat into it periodically for rest, recuperation, and renewed vigor. One of the most beneficial prescriptions that I have ever given patients is the advice to learn to return into this quiet, tranquil center. And one of the best ways that I have found for entering this quiet center is to build for yourself, in imagination, a little mental room. Furnish this room with whatever is most restful and refreshing to you. Perhaps beautiful landscapes. If you like paintings, a volume of your favorite verse if you like poetry. The colors of the walls are your own favorite pleasant colors, but should be chosen from the restful hues of blue, light green, yellow, gold. The room is plainly and simply furnished. There are no distracting elements. It is very neat and everything is in order. Simplicity, quietness, beauty are the keynotes. It contains your favorite easy chair. From one small window, you can look out and see a beautiful beach. The waves roll in upon the beach and retreat, but you cannot hear them, for your room is very, very quiet. Take as much care in building this room in your imagination as you would in building an actual room. Be thoroughly familiar with every detail. A little vacation every day. Whenever you have a few spare moments during the day between appointments or while riding the bus, retire into your quiet room. Whenever you begin to feel tension mounting or to feel hurried or harried, retire into your quiet room for a few moments. Just a very few minutes taken from a very busy day in this manner will more than pay for themselves. It is not time wasted, but time invested. Say to yourself, I'm going to rest a bit in my quiet room. Then, in imagination, see yourself climbing the stairs to your room. Say to yourself, I am now climbing the stairs. Now I am opening the door. Now I am inside. In imagination, notice all the quiet, restful details. See yourself sitting down in your favorite chair, utterly relaxed and at peace with the world. Your room is secure. Nothing can touch you here. There is nothing to worry about. You left your worries at the foot of the stairs. There are no decisions to be made here. No hurry. No bother. You need a certain amount of escapism. Yes, this is escapism. So is sleep escapism. Carrying an umbrella in the rain is escapism. Building yourself an actual house where you can retreat from the weather and the elements is escapism. And taking a vacation is escapism. Our nervous system needs a certain amount of escapism. It needs some freedom and protection from the continual bombardment of external stimuli. We need yearly vacations where we physically vacate the old scenes, the old duties, the old responsibilities, get away from it all. Your soul and your nervous system need a room for rest, recuperation, and protection every bit as much as your physical body needs a physical house. And for the same reasons. Your mental quiet room gives your nervous system a little vacation every day. For the moment, you mentally vacate your workaday world of duties, responsibilities, decisions, pressures, and get away from it all by mentally retiring into your no-pressure chamber. Pictures are more impressive to your automatic mechanism than words. Particularly so, if the picture happens to have a strong symbolic meaning. One mental picture that I have found very effective is the following. On a visit to Yellowstone National Park, I was waiting patiently for the geyser Old Faithful, which goes off approximately every hour. Suddenly, the geyser erupted in a great mass of hissing steam, like a gigantic boiler whose safety plug had blown out. A small boy standing near me asked his father, What makes it do that?
Well, said his father, I guess old Mother Earth is like the rest of us. She builds up a certain amount of pressure, and every once in a while just has to blow off steam to stay healthy. Wouldn't it be wonderful, I thought to myself, if we humans could blow off steam harmlessly like that when emotional pressures build up inside us? I didn't have a geyser or a steam valve in the top of my head, but I did have an imagination. So I began to use this mental picture when I would retire into my mental quiet room. I would remember Old Faithful and form a mental picture of emotional steam and pressure coming out the top of my head and evaporating harmlessly. Try this mental picture on yourself when you're wrought up or tense. The ideas of blowing off steam and blowing your top have powerful associations built into your mental machinery. Clear your mechanism before undertaking a new problem. If you are using an adding machine or a computer, you must clear the machine of previous problems before undertaking a new one. Otherwise, parts of the old problem or the old situation carry over into the new situation and give you a wrong answer. This exercise of retiring for a few moments into your quiet room in your mind can accomplish the same sort of clearance of your success mechanism, and for that reason, it is very helpful to practice it in between tasks, situations, and environments that require different moods, mental adjustments, or mental sets. Common examples of carryover or failure to clear your mental machinery are the following. A business executive carries his workaday worries and his workaday mood home with him. All day he has been harried, hurried, aggressive, and set to go. Perhaps he has felt a bit of frustration, which tends to make him irritable. He stops working physically when he goes home. But he carries with him a residue of his aggressiveness, frustration, hurry, and worry. He is still set to go and cannot relax. He is irritable with his wife and family. He keeps thinking about problems at the office, although there is nothing he can do about them. Insomnia and rudeness are often emotional carryovers. Many people carry their troubles to bed with them when they should be resting. Mentally and emotionally, they are still trying to do something about a situation at a time when doing is not in order. All during the day, we have need of many different types of emotional and mental organization. You need a different mood and mental organization for talking with your boss and talking with a customer. And if you have just talked with an irate and irritable customer, you need a change in set before talking with the second customer. Otherwise, emotional carryover from the one situation will be inappropriate in dealing with the other. One large company found that their executives unknowingly answered the telephone in a harsh, angry, hostile tone. The phone rang in the midst of a knockdown, drag-out conference, or while the executive was enmeshed in frustration and hostility for one reason or another, and his angry, hostile tone of voice surprised and offended the innocent caller. This company directed all executives to pause 5 seconds and smile before picking up the phone. Emotional carryover causes accidents. Insurance companies and other agencies that do research on the cause of accidents have found that emotional carryover causes many automobile accidents. If the driver has just had a spat with his wife or his boss, if he has just experienced frustration, or if he has just left a situation that called for aggressive behavior, he is much more likely to have an accident. He carries over into his driving attitudes and emotions that are inappropriate. He is really not angry at the other drivers. He is somewhat like a man who wakes up in the morning from a dream in which he experienced extreme anger. He realizes that the injustice heaped upon him happened only in a dream. but he is still angry, period. Fear can carry over in the same manner. Calmness carries over, too. But the really helpful thing to know about all this is that friendliness, love, peace, quiet, and calmness also carry over. It is impossible, as we have said, to experience or feel fear, anger, or anxiety while completely relaxed, quiet, and composed. Retiring into your quiet room thus becomes an ideal clearance mechanism for emotions and moods. Old emotions evaporate and disappear. At the same time, you experience calmness, peacefulness, and a feeling of well-being, which will also carry over into whatever activities immediately follow. Your quiet time wipes the slate clean, so to speak, clears the machine, and gives you a clean new page for the environment that is to follow. I practice the quiet time both immediately before and after surgery. Surgery requires a high degree of concentration, calmness, control. It would be disastrous to carry over into the surgical situation feelings of hurry, aggressiveness, or personal worries. Therefore, I clear my mental machinery by spending a few moments completely relaxed in my quiet room. On the other hand, the high degree of concentration, purpose, and obliviousness to surroundings that is so necessary to the surgical situation would be most inappropriate to a social situation, whether the social situation were an interview in my office or a grand ball. Therefore, upon leaving surgery, I also make it a point to spend a couple of minutes in my quiet room to clear the decks, so to speak, for a new type of action. Build your own psychic umbrella. By practicing the techniques in this chapter, you can build your own psychic umbrella, which will screen out disturbing stimuli, bring you more peace of mind, and enable you to perform better. Above all, keep in mind, and hammer it home to yourself, that the key to the matter of whether you are disturbed or tranquil, fearful or composed, is not the external stimulus, whatever it may be, but your own response and reaction. Your own response is what makes you feel fearful, anxious, insecure. If you do not respond at all, but just let the telephone ring, it is impossible for you to feel disturbed, regardless of what is happening around you. Be like the promontory against which the waves continually break. But it stands firm and tames the fury of the water around it, said Marcus Aurelius. The 91st Psalm is a vivid word picture of a man who experiences feelings of safety and security in the very midst of terrors of the night, arrows that fly by day, plagues, intrigues, snares of enemies, danger, 10,000 fall at his right side. Because he has found the secret place within his own soul and is unmoved, that is, he does not emotionally react or respond to the scare bells in his environment. Emotionally, he totally ignores them, much as William James recommended totally ignoring evil and unhappy facts to feel happy, and as James T. Mangan recommended, that is, totally ignoring adverse situations in the environment to feel poised. You are basically an actor, not a reactor. Throughout this audiobook, we have spoken of reacting and responding appropriately to environmental factors. Man, however, is not primarily a reactor, but an actor. We do not merely react and respond willy-nilly to whatever environmental factors may be present, like a ship that goes whichever way the wind happens to blow. As goal-striving beings, we first must act. We set our own goal, determine our own course. Then, within the context of this goal-striving structure, we respond and react appropriately, that is, in a manner that will further our own progress and serve our own ends. If responding and reacting to negative feedback does not take us further down the road to our own goal or serve our ends, then there is no need to respond at all. And if response of any kind gets us off course or works against us, then no response is the appropriate response. Your emotional stabilizer. In almost any goal-striving situation, our own inner stability is in itself an important goal to maintain. We must be sensitive to negative feedback data that advises us when we are off course, so that we can change direction and go forward. But at the same time, we must keep our own ship afloat and stable. Our ship must not be tossed and rocked and perhaps sunk by every passing wave, or even a serious storm. As Prescott Lecky expressed it, the same attitude must be maintained in spite of environmental changes. Our letting the telephone ring is a mental attitude that keeps our stability. It keeps us from being tossed about, knocked off course, or shaken up by every wave or ripple in the environment. Stop fighting straw men. Still another type of inappropriate response that causes worry, insecurity, and tension is the bad habit of trying to respond emotionally to something that doesn't exist except in our imaginations. Not satisfied with over-responding to actual minor stimuli in the actual environment, many of us create straw men in our imaginations and emotionally respond to our own mental pictures. In addition to those negatives that actually exist in the environment, we impose our own negatives. This or that may happen. What if such and such happens? When we worry, we form mental pictures, adverse mental pictures, of what may exist in the environment, of what may happen. We then respond to these negative pictures as if they are present reality. Remember, your nervous system cannot tell the difference between a real experience and one that is vividly imagined. Doing nothing is the proper response to an unreal problem. Again, you can tranquilize yourself against this sort of disturbance, not by something you do, but by something you don't do, your refusal to respond. As far as your emotions are concerned, the proper response to worry pictures is to totally ignore them. Live emotionally in the present moment. Analyze your environment. Become more aware of what actually exists in your environment and respond and react spontaneously to that. In order to do this, you must give all your attention to what is happening now. You must keep your eye on the ball. Then, your response will be appropriate, and you will have no time to notice or respond to a fictitious environment. Your first aid kit. Carry these thoughts with you as a sort of first aid kit. Inner disturbance, or the opposite of tranquility, is nearly always caused by over-response, a too-sensitive alarm reaction. You create a built-in tranquilizer or psychic screen between yourself and the disturbing stimulus when you practice not responding, letting the telephone ring. You cure old habits of over-response. You extinguish old conditioned reflexes when you practice delaying the habitual, automatic, and unthinking response. Relaxation is nature's own tranquilizer. Relaxation is non-response. Learn physical relaxation by daily practice. Then when you need to practice non-response in daily activities, just do what you're doing when you relax. Use the quiet room in your mind technique both as a daily tranquilizer to tone down nervous response and to clear your emotional mechanism of carryover emotions that would be inappropriate in a new situation. Stop scaring yourself to death with your own mental pictures. Stop fighting straw men. Emotionally, respond only to what actually is here and now, and ignore the rest. Your spiritual thermostat. Your physical body has a built-in thermostat, itself a servo mechanism, that maintains your inner physical temperature at a steady 98.6 degrees, regardless of the temperature in the environment. The weather around you may be freezing cold or 110 degrees, yet your body maintains its own climate, a steady 98.6. It is able to function properly in the environment because it does not take on itself the climate of the environment. Cold or hot, it maintains its own. You also have a built-in spiritual thermostat that enables you to maintain an emotional climate and atmosphere in spite of the emotional weather around you. Many people do not use this spiritual thermostat because they do not know it is there. They do not know such a thing is possible, and they do not understand that they do not have to take on the outward climate. Yet your spiritual thermostat is just as necessary for emotional health and well-being as your physical thermostat is for physical health. Begin using it now by practicing the techniques in this chapter. Practice exercise. Create in your imagination a vivid mental picture of yourself sitting quietly, composed, unmoved, letting your telephone ring, as outlined earlier in this chapter. Then, in your daily activities, carry over the same peaceful, composed, unmoved attitude by remembering this mental picture. Say to yourself, "I'm letting the telephone ring," whenever you are tempted to obey or respond to some fear bell or anxiety bell. Next, use your imagination to practice non-response in various sorts of situations. See yourself sitting quietly and unmoved while an associate rants and raves. See yourself going through your daily tasks one by one, calmly, composed, unhurried, in spite of the pressures of a busy day. See yourself maintaining the same constant, stable course, in spite of the various hurry bells and pressure bells in your environment. See yourself in various situations that have in the past upset you, only now you remain set, settled, poised, by not responding. At this point, you are welcome to pause the audio program and consider some of the key points that you've heard articulated in this chapter, as well as to consider some experiences you've had throughout your life that bring the concepts and principles to life for you. Chapter 13, How to Turn a Crisis into a Creative Opportunity. I know a young golfer who holds the all-time course record for his home course, yet has never even placed in a really big tournament. When playing by himself or with friends or in small tournaments where the stakes are low, his play is flawless. Yet each time he gets into a big tournament, his game deteriorates. In the language of golfdom, the pressure gets him. Many baseball pitchers have pinpoint control until they find themselves in a situation where the chips are down. Then they choke up, lose all control, and appear to have no ability whatever. On the other hand, many athletes perform better under pressure. The situation itself seems to give them more strength, more power, more finesse. People who come into their own in a crisis. For example, John Thomas, the record-breaking high jumper from Boston University, often performed better in competition than in practice. In February 1960, Thomas set a world's record, clearing 7 feet, 1 1/4 inches at the U.S. Indoor Championships. His highest previous jump in practice had been 6 feet, 9 1/4 inches. It isn't always the baseball player with the highest batting average who is called upon as a pinch hitter in a tough spot. The manager frequently turns down the man with the highest batting average for a player who is known to come through in the clutch. One salesman may find himself inarticulate in the presence of an important prospect. His skills desert him. Another salesman, under the same circumstances, may sell over his head. The challenge of the situation brings out abilities he does not ordinarily possess. Many women are charming and gracious when talking with one person or a small informal group, but become tongue-tied, awkward, and dull at a formal dinner or a big social occasion. On the other hand, I know a woman who comes into her own only under the stimulus of a big occasion. If you had dinner with her alone, you would find her very ordinary. Her features are not particularly attractive. Her personality is somewhat on the drab side. But all this changes when she attends an important party. The stimulus of the occasion awakens and brings to life something within her. Her eyes acquire a new sparkle. Her conversation is witty and charming. Even her facial features seem to undergo a change, and you find yourself thinking of her as a beautiful woman. There are students who do extremely well in day-to-day classwork, but find their minds a blank when taking an examination. There are other students who are ordinary in classwork, but do extremely well on important examinations. The secret of the money player. The difference between all these persons is not some inherent quality that one has and another hasn't. It is largely a matter of how they learn to react to crisis situations. A crisis is a situation that can either make you or break you. If you react properly to the situation, a crisis can give you strength, power, wisdom you do not ordinarily possess. If you react improperly, a crisis can rob you of the skill, control, and ability that you ordinarily have to call upon. The so-called money player in sports, in business, or in social activities, the person who comes through in the clutch, who performs better under the stimulus of challenge, is invariably the person who has learned either consciously or unconsciously to react well to crisis situations. In order to perform well in a crisis, 1. We need to learn certain skills under conditions where we will not be over-motivated. We need to practice without pressure. 2. We need to learn to react to crises with an aggressive rather than a defensive attitude, to respond to the challenge in the situation rather than to the menace, to keep our positive goal in mind. 3. We need to learn to evaluate so-called crisis situations in their true perspective, to not make mountains out of molehills, or react as if every small challenge is a matter of life or death. 1. Practice without pressure. Although we may learn fast, we do not learn well under crisis conditions. Throw a man who can't swim into water over his head, and the crisis itself may give him the power to swim to safety. He learns fast and manages to swim somehow. But he will never learn to become a championship swimmer. The crude, inept stroke that he used to rescue himself becomes fixed, and it is difficult for him to learn better ways of swimming. Because of his ineptness, he may perish in a real crisis where he is required to swim a long distance. Dr. Edward C. Tolman, psychologist and founder of the concept known as latent learning, said that both animals and men form brain maps, or cognitive maps of the environment while they are learning. If the motivation is not too intense, if there is not too much of a crisis present in the learning situation, These maps are broad and general. If the animal is overmotivated, the cognitive map is narrow and restricted. He learns just one way of solving his problem. In the future, if this one way happens to be blocked, the animal becomes frustrated and fails to discern alternative routes or detours. He develops a cut-and-dried, preconceived singular response and tends to lose the ability to react spontaneously to a new situation. He cannot improvise. He can only follow a set plan. Pressure retards learning. Dr. Tolman found that if rats were permitted to learn and practice under non-crisis conditions, they later performed well in a crisis. For example, if rats were permitted to roam about at will and explore a maze when well fed and with plenty to drink, they did not appear to learn anything. Later, however, if the same rats were placed in the maze while hungry, they showed they had learned a great deal by quickly and efficiently going to the goal. Hunger faced these trained rats with a crisis to which they reacted well. Other rats, which were forced to learn the maze under the crisis of hunger and thirst, did not do so well. They were overmotivated, and their brain maps became narrow. The one correct route to the goal became fixated. If this route were blocked, the rats became frustrated and had great difficulty learning a new one. The more intense the crisis situation under which you learn, the less you learn. Professor Jerome S. Bruner, who made significant contributions to human cognitive psychology and cognitive learning theory in educational psychology, trained two groups of rats to solve a maze to get food. One group, which had not eaten for 12 hours, learned the maze in 6 trials. A second group, which had eaten nothing for 36 hours, required more than 20 tries. Fire drills teach crisis conduct in a non-crisis situation. People react in the same way. Persons who have to learn how to get out of an actual burning building will normally require 2 or 3 times as long to learn the proper escape route as they would if no fire were present. Some of them do not learn at all. Overmotivation interferes with reasoning processes. The automatic reaction mechanism is jammed by too much conscious effort, trying too hard. Something akin to purpose tremor develops, and the ability to think clearly is lost. The ones who do manage somehow to get out of the building have then learned a narrow, fixated response. Put them in a different building, or change the circumstances slightly, and they react as badly the second time around as the first. But you can take these same people and let them practice a dry run fire drill when there is no fire. Because there is no menace, there is no excessive negative feedback to interfere with clear thinking or correct doing. They practice filing out of the building calmly, efficiently, and correctly. After they have practiced this exercise a number of times, they can be counted on to act the same way when an actual fire breaks out. Their muscles, nerves, and brain have memorized a broad, general, flexible map. The attitude of calmness and clear thinking will carry over from practice drill to actual fire. Moreover, they will have learned something about how to get out of any building or cope with any changed circumstances about the crisis. They are not committed to a rigid response, but will be able to improvise, to react spontaneously to whatever conditions may be present. The moral is obvious for either mice or men. Practice without pressure, and you will learn more efficiently and be able to perform better in a crisis situation. Shadow boxing for stability. Gentleman Jim Corbett, the renowned world heavyweight champion boxer, made the word shadow boxing popular. When asked how he developed the perfect control and timing for his left jab, which he used to cut John L. Sullivan, the Boston strong boy, to ribbons, Corbett replied that he had practiced throwing his left at his own image in the mirror more than 10,000 times in preparation for the bout. Gene Tunney did the same thing. Years before he actually fought Jack Dempsey in the ring, he had fought an imaginary Dempsey more than 100 times in the privacy of his own room. He secured all the films of old Dempsey fights. He watched them until he knew every one of Dempsey's moves. Then he shadowboxed. He would imagine that Dempsey was standing before him. When the imaginary Dempsey would make a certain move, he would practice his counter move. Sir Harry Lauder, the famous Scottish actor and comedian, once admitted that he had practiced a certain routine 10,000 times in private before ever giving the performance publicly. Lauder was, in effect, shadowboxing with an imaginary audience. Billy Graham preached sermons to cypress stumps in a Florida swamp before developing his compelling platform personality with live audiences. Most good public speakers have done the same thing in one way or another. The most common form of shadowboxing for public speakers is to deliver their speech to their own image in the mirror. One man I know lines up 6 or 8 empty chairs, imagines people sitting in them, and practices his speech on the imaginary audience. Easy practice brings better scores. When Ben Hogan played tournament golf regularly, he kept a golf club in his bedroom and practiced daily in private, swinging the club correctly and without pressure at an imaginary golf ball. When Hogan was on the links, he would go through the correct motions in his imagination before making a shot, and then depend on muscle memory to execute the shot correctly. Some athletes practice in private with as little pressure as possible. They, or their coaches, refuse to permit the press to witness practice sessions, and even refuse to give out any information concerning their practice for publicity purposes, in order to protect themselves from pressure. Everything is arranged to make training and practice as relaxed and pressure-free as is humanly possible. The result is that they go into the crisis of actual competition without appearing to have any nerves at all. They become human icicles, immune to pressure, not worrying about how they will perform, but depending on muscle memory to execute the various motions that they have learned. The technique of shadowboxing, or practice without pressure, is so simple, and the results often so striking, that some people are inclined to associate it with some sort of magic. I remember a dowager, for example, who for years had been jittery, felt ill at ease in social situations. After practicing shadowboxing, she wrote me, "I must have practiced making a grand entrance in my own empty living room 100 times or more. I walked down the room, shaking hands with innumerable imaginary guests. I smiled and had something friendly to say to each one, actually saying the words out loud. Then I moved about among the guests, chatting here and there. I practiced walking, sitting, talking, gracefully and self-confidently. I cannot tell you how happy I was, and I might say somewhat surprised, at the wonderful time I had at the GT ball. I felt relaxed and confident. Several situations came up which I had not anticipated nor practiced, but I found myself ad-libbing them admirably. My husband is sure that you work some sort of mumbo-jumbo on me." Matt Fury commentary. The results you get from sitting in a chair and visualizing are phenomenal. Even so, you would be wise to pay heed to the following Dr. Maltz sentence again. The technique of shadowboxing, or practice without pressure, is so simple, and the results often so striking, that some people are inclined to associate it with some sort of magic. Personally, I don't think magic is too strong a word. I've taught the technique of shadow boxing to many people who have never boxed or done any type of combat sport in their lives. I've taught it to salespeople, musicians, artists, writers, and people who have a goal to be healthier. All have used it effectively. Now back to Dr. Maltz. Shadow boxing turns on self-expression. The word express literally means to push out, to exert, to show forth. The word inhibit means to choke off, restrict. Self-expression is a pushing out, a showing forth of the powers, talents, and abilities of the self. It means turning on your own light and letting it shine. Self-expression is a yes response. Inhibition is a no response. It chokes off self-expression, turns off or dims your light. In shadow boxing, you practice self-expression with no inhibiting factors present. You learn the correct moves. You form a mental map that is retained in memory. You create a broad, general, flexible map. Then when you face a crisis where an actual menace or inhibiting factor is present, you have learned to act calmly and correctly. There is a carryover in your muscles, nerves, and brain from practice to the actual situation. Moreover, because your learning has been relaxed and pressure-free, you will be able to rise to the occasion, extemporize, improvise, act spontaneously. At the same time, your shadow boxing is building a mental image of yourself, acting correctly and successfully. The memory of this successful self-image also enables you to perform better. Dry shooting is the secret of good marksmanship. A novice on the pistol range will quite often find that he can hold the handgun perfectly still and motionless as long as he's not trying to shoot. When he aims an empty gun at a target, his hand is steady. When the same gun is loaded and he attempts to make a score, purpose tremor sets in. The gun barrel uncontrollably moves up and down, back and forth, in much the same way that your hand tremors when you attempt to thread a needle. Almost to a man, all good pistol coaches recommend lots of dry run target shooting to overcome this condition. The marksman calmly and deliberately aims, cocks, and snaps a handgun at a target on the wall. Calmly and deliberately, he pays attention to just how he is holding the gun, whether it is canted or not, whether he is squeezing or jerking the trigger. He learns good habits calmly. There is no purpose tremor because there is no over-carefulness, no over-anxiety for results. After thousands of such dry runs, the novice will find that he can hold the loaded gun and actually shoot it while maintaining the same mental attitude and going through the same calm, deliberate physical motions. A friend of mine learned to shoot quail in much the same manner. Although he was a good shot on the skeet range, the roar of a quail as it took off and his anxiety for results or over-motivation caused him to miss almost every time. On his next hunt, and after learning about shadow boxing, he carried an empty shotgun the first day. There was no need to get excited because he couldn't shoot anyway. No need for over-motivation when you're carrying an empty gun. He shot some 20 quail that day with the empty gun. By the time he had made his first 6 shots, all anxiety and jitteriness had left him. His companions thought he had lost a few of his buttons. But he redeemed himself the next day when he killed his first 8 birds and got a total of 15 quail out of 17 shots. Shadow boxing helps you hit the ball. Not long ago, I visited a friend of mine one Sunday in a suburb of New York. His 10-year-old son had visions of becoming a big league baseball star. His fielding was adequate, but he couldn't hit. Each time his father threw the ball across the plate, the boy froze up and missed it by a foot. I decided to try something. You're so anxious to hit the ball and so afraid you won't that you can't even see it clearly, I said. All that tension and anxiety was interfering with his eyesight and his reflexes. His arm muscles weren't executing the orders from his brain. For the next 10 pitches, I said, don't even try to hit the ball. Don't try at all. Keep your bat on your shoulder, but watch the ball very carefully. Keep your eyes on it from the time it leaves your daddy's hand until it goes by you. Stand easy and loose, and just watch the ball go by. After 10 trials of this, I advised him, now for a while, watch the ball go by and keep the bat on your shoulder, but think to yourself you're going to bring the bat around so it will really hit the ball, solidly and dead center. After this, I told him to keep on feeling the same way, and to keep watching the ball carefully, and to let the bat come around and meet the ball, making no attempt to hit it hard. The boy hit the ball. After a few easy hits like this, he was knocking the ball a country mile, and I had a friend for life. The salesman who practiced not selling. You can use the same technique to hit the ball in selling, teaching, or running a business. A young salesman complained to me that he froze up when calling on prospects. His one big trouble was his inability to properly reply to the prospect's objections. When a prospect raises an objection or criticizes my product, I can't think of a thing to say at the time, he said. Later, I can think of all kinds of good ways to handle the objection. I told him about shadow boxing and about the kid who learned to bat by letting the ball go by with the bat on his shoulder. I pointed out that to hit a baseball, or to think on your feet, requires good reflexes. Your automatic success mechanism must respond appropriately and automatically. Too much tension, too much motivation, too much anxiety for results jams the mechanism. You think of the proper answers later because you've relaxed and the pressure is off. Right now, your trouble is you're not responding quickly and spontaneously to the objections your prospects throw at you. In other words, you're not hitting the ball that the prospect throws. I told him, first of all, to practice a number of imaginary interviews, actually walking in, introducing himself to a prospect, making his sales pitch, then imagine every possible objection, no matter how screwballish, and answer it out loud. Next, he was to practice with his bat on his shoulder, on an actual live client. He was to go in with an empty gun as far as intents and purposes were concerned. The purpose of the sales interview would not be to sell. He had to resign himself to being satisfied with no order. The purpose of the call would be strictly practice, bat on the shoulder, empty gun practice. In his own words, this shadow boxing worked like a miracle. As a young medical student, I used to shadow box surgical operations on cadavers. This no-pressure practice taught me much more than technique. It taught a future surgeon calmness, deliberateness, clear thinking, because he had practiced all these things in a situation that was not do or die, life or death. How to make your nerves work for you. The word crisis comes from a Greek word that means literally decisiveness or point of decision. A crisis is a fork in the road. One fork holds a promise of a better condition, the other of a worse condition. In medicine, the crisis is a turning point where the patient either gets worse and dies or gets better and lives. Thus, every crisis situation is two-pronged. The pitcher who goes in the ninth inning with the score tied and three men on base can become a hero and gain in prestige. Or he can become a villain who loses the game. Hugh Casey, who is one of the most successful and the calmest relief pitchers of all time, was once asked what he thought of when he was sent into a game in the middle of a crisis situation. "I always think about what I am going to do and what I want to happen," he said, "instead of what the batter is going to do or what may happen to me." He said he concentrated on what he wanted to happen, felt that he could make it happen, and that it usually did. The same attitude is another important key to reacting well in any crisis situation. If we can maintain an aggressive attitude, react aggressively instead of negatively to threats and crises, the very situation itself can act as a stimulus to release untapped powers. Several years ago, newspapers carried the story about a giant of a man who did what two wrecking trucks and a score of men could not do. He raised the crushed metal cab of a truck off its pin driver. He ripped out with his bare hands the brake pedal that had the driver's foot trapped, and he beat out the flames in the floor of the cab with his bare hands. Later, when this giant was found and identified, he turned out to be not a giant at all. Charles Dennis Jones was 6 feet 2 inches tall and weighed 220. His explanation for his extraordinary feat: "I hate fire." 14 months before, his 8-year-old daughter had burned to death in a fire that had leveled his residence. "I knew a tall, rather frail man who single-handedly somehow managed to carry an upright piano out of his house, down 3 steps, up over a 4-inch curb, and out to the center of his lawn when his house was on fire. It had required 6 strong men to place the piano in the house. One rather frail man, under the stimulus of excitement and crisis, took it out by himself." 2. Crisis brings power. Neurologist J.A. Hadfield has made an extensive study in the extraordinary powers, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual, that come to the aid of ordinary men and women in times of crisis. How wonderful is the way in which, with quite ordinary folk, power leaps to our aid in any time of emergency, he said. "We lead timid lives, shrinking from difficult tasks till perhaps we are forced into them or ourselves determine on them, and immediately we seem to unlock the unseen forces. When we have to face danger, then courage comes. When trial puts a long, continued strain upon us, we find ourselves possessed by the power to endure, or when disaster ultimately brings the fall which we so long dreaded, we feel underneath us the strength as of the everlasting arms. Common experience teaches that, when great demands are made upon us, if only we fearlessly accept the challenge and confidently expend our strength, every danger or difficulty brings its own strength. As thy days, so shall thy strength be." The secret lies in the attitude of fearlessly accepting the challenge and confidently expending our strength. This means maintaining an aggressive, goal-directed attitude rather than a defensive, evasive, negative one. "No matter what happens, I can handle it," or "I can see it through," rather than "I hope nothing happens." Keep your goal in mind. The essence of this aggressive attitude is remaining goal-oriented. You keep your own positive goal in mind. You intend to go through the crisis experience to achieve your goal. You keep your original positive goal and do not get sidetracked into secondary ones, the desire to run away, to hide, to avoid the crisis situation. Or in the language of William James, your attitude is one of fight instead of one of fear or flight. If you can do this, The crisis situation itself acts as a stimulus that releases additional power to help you accomplish your goal. Prescott Lecky, author of Self-Consistency, A Theory of Personality, has said that the purpose of emotion is reinforcement or additional strength rather than to serve as a sign of weakness. He believed that there was only one basic emotion, excitement, and that excitement manifests itself as fear, anger, courage, etc., depending on our own inner goals at the time, whether we are inwardly organized to conquer a problem, run away from it, or destroy it. The real problem is not to control emotion, wrote Lecky, but to control the choice of which tendency shall receive emotional reinforcement. If your intention or your attitude, goal, is to go forward, if it is to make the most of the crisis situation and win out in spite of it, then the excitement of the occasion will reinforce this tendency. It will give you more courage, more strength to go forward. If you lose sight of your original goal and your attitude goal becomes one of running away from the crisis, of seeking to somehow get past it by evading it, this running away tendency will also be reinforced, and you will experience fear and anxiety. Don't mistake excitement for fear. Many people have made the mistake of habitually interpreting the feeling of excitement as fear and anxiety, and therefore interpreting it as a proof of inadequacy. Any normal person who is intelligent enough to understand the situation becomes excited or nervous just before a crisis situation. Until you direct it toward a goal, this excitement is neither fear, anxiety, courage, confidence, nor anything else other than a stepped-up, reinforced supply of emotional steam in your boiler. It is not a sign of weakness. It is a sign of additional strength to be used in any way you choose. Jack Dempsey used to get so nervous before a fight, he couldn't shave himself. His excitement was such that he couldn't sit or stand still. He did not, however, interpret this excitement as fear. He did not decide that he should run away because of it. He went forward and used the excitement to put extra dynamite into his blows. Experienced actors know that this feeling of excitement just before a performance is a good token. Many of them deliberately work themselves up emotionally just before going on stage. The good soldier is usually the man who feels excited just before battle. Many people place their bets at racetracks on the basis of which horse appears to be the most nervous just before going to the post. Trainers also know that a horse that becomes nervous or spirited just before a race will perform better than usual. The term spirited is a good one. The excitement that you feel just before a crisis situation is an infusion of spirit and should be so interpreted by you. Not long ago, I met a man on a plane whom I had not seen for several years. In the course of conversation, I asked if he still made as many public speeches as he had in the past. Yes, he said. As a matter of fact, he had changed jobs so that he would be able to speak more and now made at least one public speech every day. Knowing his love for public speaking, I commented that it was good he had this type of work. Yes, he said. In one way it is good, but in another way it is not so good. I don't make as many good speeches now as I used to. I speak so often that it has become old hat to me, and I no longer feel that little tingly feeling in the pit of my stomach, which tells me that I'm going to do well. Some people become so excited during an important written examination that they are unable to think clearly or even hold a pencil steadily in their hands. Other people become so aroused under the same circumstances that they perform over their heads. Their minds work better and clearer than usual. Memory is sharpened.